From the Moan Broadcast Center, it's Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Coming up this week, our critics review First Man, starring Ryan Gosling as astronaut Neil Armstrong, the man who, of course, first set foot on the moon. Bad Times at the El Royale, a mystery thriller starring Jeff Bridges and John Hamm. Those and more movies to come on Film Week. Great to have you with us on Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle, joined this week by critics Amy Nicholson, film writer for The Guardian and host of the podcast miniseries Halloween Unmasked. 8 parts looking at the film Halloween, which was filmed right here in Southern California. Tim Cogshell of Alt Film Guide and Cinegods.com. We begin with First Man, highly anticipated biographical drama from Oscar-winning director Damien Chazelle. He teams up once again with Ryan Gosling, like they did in La La Land. But this time, Gosling is Neil Armstrong, alongside Claire Foy, who plays Armstrong's wife, Janet. Film based on the true story of the 1969 mission to the moon that led Armstrong to be the first man to walk on the lunar surface.
Neil, if it does turn out, you'll go down in history. What kind of thoughts do you have about that when the thought hits you? Suppose that flight successful?
We're planning on that flight being successful.
First Man, written by Josh Singer, based on James R. Hansen's book. Tim, what'd you think of First Man?
And perhaps constrained a little bit by that book. Close-ups is the first thing that I think of. When folks go see this movie, the thing that they're going to notice is the way that it is actually composed, which is almost in a series of extreme close-ups. Some of them are very effective. Gosling's eyes through the helmet, dials and switches and things like that. Even when the film widens a bit, we mostly only widen to sort of loose medium shots. Very seldom is there a shot in this film that is a head-to-toe human being. It's intentional. It's meant to create a sense of claustrophobia and perspective and point of view. Here's the thing about this film. As much as I wanted to like it, it feels like a film that might have been made by Steven Spielberg or Scorsese or Coppola, any of the cast, any of the grand, wonderful filmmakers of my generation, say. But it doesn't feel like a Damien Chazelle film. And I it may not be fair to say that there ought to be something called a Damien Chazelle. He's only made 4. But I thought that there was, and I thought that I could identify them. But I swear to you, you could swap him out for almost any of those directors, and this film feels like that, which isn't a bad thing. It just wasn't expected, and I'm disappointed.
What'd you think, Amy?
I'm not quite sure it's up to the level of Spielberg. Yeah, I feel like Damien Chazelle is going for this Wizard of Oz thing, where it's so close, so grainy, where you're studying Ryan Gosling's pores like they're the surface of the moon. Just so at the end, when he lands on the moon, he can pull back for that, ta-da, here is Oz, here is the moon shot, which is gorgeous, and it feels like you're exhaling for the first time, and it's also 2 hours into the movie. So I wasn't the biggest fan of this. On an emotional level, I love a story about when Americans put science first, about when we dared to dream really big. But that's just the facts and the beats of the case. The movie itself, I was pretty underwhelmed by. Although if people have recently seen Free Solo, the documentary that came out a couple weeks ago about the freehand mountain climber who climbed El Capitan, there are scenes in here where you realize, oh, Ryan Gosling, if you put his character, if you put his Neil Armstrong in an MRA, he has the same lack of fear. And the two men feel incredibly parallel. So that's interesting, but the movie doesn't really go far with it.
And of course, this film is about Armstrong. It's a biopic about him. It's not really about the space race at all. The space race just sort of encapsulates the context of it all. So we spend a lot of time with him and his family. As much as I am a fan, or really a horrible dilettante, really of the space race, I did not know that he had a daughter who had passed away in 1961. The year that I was born. And so by 1969, when all of this is happening, I'm 8 years old, I'm looking at the moon. And all of this happened in a span of only 60 years from when the Wright brothers first took flight. It's all of that is quite amazing. As a biopic, though, that's where I think it might fail the most. As a biopic, I still don't know anything about Neil Armstrong, and I met him twice.
Wow.
Oh, wow. I was torn with that same plot point because I didn't know that about him either. And yet I think at this level of watching biopics and biopics and biopics, I feel so immune to the dead daughter thing where the daughter's showing up in flashbacks constantly where everything is revolved through her. And then also having the wife at home just being sad and nervous. It's a shame, I guess, that so many of our biopics do follow the same beats of a man's life. So you're right. I wish there was more Neil Armstrong there.
We're talking about First Man, a biographical picture about Neil Armstrong. Ryan Gosling stars, Damien Chazelle directed. It's rated PG-13 in wide release. Damien Chazelle was on the frame with John Horn recently. And if you want to hear that interview, just visit our Film Week page. We have a link to kpcc.org/theframe. And coming up later on the program, rocket scientist Anita Sengupta, who was with us earlier in the week, and she happened to mention to me off air that she thought First Man was the best film on space that she had seen, that most got it right. We're going to find out why she thought that coming up. A true rocket scientist, formerly of JPL, and now with Virgin Hyperloop One. We'll hear what she has to say later on. Next up, it's the mystery thriller Bad Times at the El Royale. Stars an ensemble cast headed by Jeff Bridges, John Hamm, Dakota Johnson, and Chris Hemsworth. A movie centers around seven strangers, each with a secret, who meet at Lake Tahoe's El Royale, a rundown hotel with a dark past.
This is not a place for a priest, Father. You shouldn't be here.
We might need to work on your sales pitch, son. The El Royale, no place for a priest.
There are other hotels, Father. Maybe closer to Tahoe, I could help you find one. I'm sure you would be happier there.
Miles, is it? If this is not a place for a priest, Miles, then this is exactly where the Lord wants me.
Bad Times at the El Royale. I couldn't tell whether this movie was going to be tongue-in-cheek or not, Amy.
It is so fun. I enjoyed the devil out of this movie. I saw it last night at a theater with a crowd, and I thought it was so enjoyable. It's written and directed by Drew Goddard, who people may know for The Cabin in the Woods. Like, he takes genre pictures, in that case like a horror slasher film, and he finds all the wrinkles in it and makes fun of them, makes fun of the pattern. Here, this is, you know, we've seen a lot of strangers and mysterious things and people with guns movies, but he does this one so intelligently and so cleverly. The El Royale is a motel set in right on the border between California and Nevada, with a red line dividing it in half. Half the motel looks one way. California rooms are a dollar more expensive.
It's funny. And like the real Cal Neva Lodge, which is right on the swimming pool, has a line go right through the middle of it.
Well, yes. I'm booking a trip because it looked amazing. And he does in here kind of shape-shifting with all of the characters. You show up thinking they're one way. Everybody reverses. And I can't say that the movie is incredibly emotionally deep, but you can say that he tries. He tries to give emotional beats, especially when you have this character who's a singer played by Cynthia Erivo, who people might know. She was part of the 2015 Color of Purple revival, in which she won an Emmy, a Grammy, and a Tony. So she only needs one more to get her EGOT immediately before we all find out who she is. She's awesome in this.
Yeah. This movie, yes, Drew Goddard, Cabin in the Sky, but he's channeling our Quentin Tarantino. He is. This is part Pulp Fiction, part Four Rooms, set in about 1972. You got Nixon on television talking all the time, and the war in Vietnam, and something that looks like the Manson murders, but isn't the Manson murders, sort of playing out on the television all the time. As we watch what goes on in these rooms and how these characters start to intermingle and cross over, this movie opens so hot, and that might be the problem of it. If it has a problem, is that it opens so hot, it's going to be tough to stick the landing. And it doesn't quite stick the landing, because it almost has to end ordinarily, because it opens so hot. Good movie. Don't be too disappointed at the end, because just go along for the ride. Oh, Jeff Bridges, he is just outstanding in this movie.
All right. Bad Times at the El Royale, written and directed by Drew Goddard. It's rated R in wide release. The Oath, the comedy from first-time director Ike Barinholtz, who also stars in the movie with Tiffany Haddish. Kerry Brownstein and Billy Magnuson also star. It's a movie about how one politically divided family's Thanksgiving turns ugly when an argument starts over an oath that Americans are required to sign, pledging loyalty to the government.
This is not the America that I know.
Christopher, we said we're not talking politics.
I'm not going to ruin Thanksgiving, I promise. Rest assured.
You are Nazis!
Like everything about liberals, as soon as they're triggered, they call everyone a Nazi.
Oh, shut up, Katie.
No politics.
You treat people who don't agree with everything you say like they're morons.
Wasn't that long ago, if you worked for a California community college, you had to sign one of those lawyers. I had to sign it when I worked at Pasadena City College. The Oath is the film. What'd you think, Amy?
I mean, it gave me the absolute shivers. I don't know if anybody else got any shivers hearing that clip. I don't know if this is the movie people might want to see with their families on Thanksgiving. It depends on how much you get along with them politically. But it is about a moment a lot like now, where there is the slow burn. They have about 7 months heads up to this Thanksgiving, warning all of Americans that they should sign this loyalty oath. Not a big deal. You might get a tax break if you do. Everyone's downplaying it. And Ike Barinholtz, who people know him as a comedian, he was in Blockers a few months ago. He writes and directs this. This is his first film. He's a very stubborn, hard-headed guy who's just not going to do it. And his wife, Tiffany Haddish, says she really agrees with him. And most of the family that he has is in different shades of just sign it, you liberal freak. I think it builds to a terrific point. The first half of this film I thought was really funny. The second half, it turns into more of a horror film, which I wasn't quite expecting, and I liked it a little bit less. But the first half of this, I was absolutely sold.
Yeah, a dark comedy for sure. Approaching that sort of Very Bad Things level of dark comedy. Not so much Bad Santa dark comedy, which is great.
Yeah.
So we go there. In case it's not obvious, Ike is white and Tiffany is black, and they have an interracial daughter. This oath thing has all kinds of sort of and the thing of it is, you're not required to sign the oath. You probably ought to sign the oath. And he is just so hardcore liberal. I mean, he is not going to sign this oath. All his friends are not going to. And one by one, they fall away. One by one, they fall away. And he is just not going to let it go. I like that about this movie. There are these people roaming around who are some sort of like, I don't know, quasi cops, but not cops. And they look into people to see whether or not they've signed the oath. And two of these guys, one played by John Cho, come to his house. And they want to know whether or not he signed the oath. And he's not having it. And that's when it starts to spiral out of control. It does get ugly. It does get brutal. It does get mean. I think it saves itself right at the end, to my mind.
I agree. And I was really impressed by Tiffany Haddish, by the way. She is very underplayed in this. She's almost showing, I have range, put me in dramas as well, which I was very impressed by.
Yeah, although it's funny. We should say it's funny. It really is funny.
It is funny.
It is funny.
The Oath, the action comedy directed, written by, and starring Ike Barinholtz with Tiffany Haddish and Kerry Brownstein. The film is rated R. It's at selected theaters. Goosebumps 2, Haunted Halloween, based on the books by R.L. Stine. This film version directed by Ari Sindel. What'd you think, Tim?
Well, all right. So you have a completely different cast, different writers, different directors. And Jack Black shows up for about 3 minutes in the whole daggum movie. That first movie was so good because it was all about Jack Black and what was going on. It really had to do with how we use horror. This is just a Halloween movie. So you have this puppet named Slappy, and he's this creepy little puppet, one of those creepy puppets, and he's walking around, and he wants a family. So he latches onto this little family, and they don't really want him, so he gets mad, so he starts to bring all of the Halloween monsters to life. Some of the animation in this is really, really, really good. There are these witches with these green pumpkin heads that are just absolutely frightening, and a giant spider, but just sort of like you slip into this movie, and you're wondering, what does this have to do with R.L. Stine again? Because there are no R.L. Stine creatures actually in it. And then Jack Black shows up and the movie's over.
All right, that's it in a nutshell. In a Goosebump. Goosebumps 2, Haunted Halloween. It's rated PG and wide release, starring Jeremy Ray Taylor and Khalil Harris, R.A. Sandell, the director, Rob Lieber, the screenwriter adapting or basing it on the books of R.L. Stine. Also want to let you know, tickets just on sale today for our next Film Week screening Sunday afternoon. First time we've done a matinee in the series. Sunday afternoon, December 2nd, just as your holiday season gets underway, chance for you to come see The Artist at the Theater at Ace Hotel, downtown Los Angeles. We'd love to have you there. It's going to be a great opportunity with our Film Week critics. Wade Major, Lael Lowenstein will be with us, and Hollywood historian and consultant on The Artist, Mark Wanamaker, also joining us. That's coming up Sunday afternoon, December 2nd, 1 o'clock. Tickets at kpecc.org/in-person. And what I'm so excited about is we're going to watch The Artist, 2011 Best Picture Oscar winner, just a couple of blocks south of where the theater scenes were actually filmed for the movie at the Tower Theater, right there on Broadway in the historic theater district. So it's going to be fun. We'll be there very close to where the movie itself was actually filmed, The Artist. And I'm a huge fan of silent films from the masters, Keaton and Chaplin, Lloyd. And when I first heard about the artist, that a French director was doing a silent film that was going to be, you know, shot in Hollywood based on this era when movies went from silent to talkies, as a little skeptical until I saw the film and then loved it like so many others, as well as the Academy. The Artist, Theater at Ace Hotel, Sunday afternoon. You buy your tickets now, you get the best choice of seats. KPCC.org/in-person. We have a lot more reviews coming up, including the drama Sadie and the biographical flick Beautiful Boy, here on Film Week on KPCC. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle with Tim Cogshell and Amy Nicholson. Next up, the drama Sadie, starring Sophia Mitry-Schloss, Melanie Lynskey, and John Gallagher Jr. It's written and directed by Megan Griffiths. Tim, what'd you think?
Well, this is actually my favorite movie of the week. This is just a wonderful little independent film with no movie stars or anything like that. Megan has done quite a bit of directing, including Animal Kingdom, the television version of Animal Kingdom. She knocked out a few of those that were really, really good. So this is about this young woman, a teenager, and her little friend, and they live in this trailer park and with her mother. Her father is away at one of the wars and has been gone for a really long time. And she's very, very deeply attached to her father, we can tell. But we can also tell that there's something sort of odd going on there. Her mother is a nurse. And this guy, just a guy, a regular guy, moves into the trailer next door and starts up a relationship with her mom. And she's just not having it. And it's about that, the way she's coming of age and trying to protect her father's spot. And she's just a little soldier, she is, just like her father. But she's going to have to deal with some realities. And this movie just moves along so methodically. The language is just so true and so real. And she is just extraordinary. When you can see her break when her heart breaks. You can just see it in her eyes. That's just a gift.
Do you know if this is the debut of the actress?
I did not. You know, I should have looked that up. I didn't look it up. It's not the debut of Megan, but I can't believe that this would be her first project.
Yeah, Sadie is the film. What do you think, Amy?
I agree. I really, really, really loved it. I mean, this went high on my list as soon as I saw that Melanie Lynskey was involved, because she is consistently one of our absolute best actresses. And here she's living this, you know, drama of a woman who's married to a husband who's not writing her letters anymore, who's being pursued a bit by Anthony Hale. He plays Buster on Arrested Development. He's also the principal at her daughter's school. And then also this new man who moves into her trailer park, who has a pill addiction, who she wants to help so much. She has a very big bleeding heart. It's very messy. She's living in this one film. Her daughter's living in this other one, where every man who enters their life is a direct threat to her father. And the child is just unable to see this through her mother's eyes at all. And that clash, that daughter's fear that her mom is being selfish, winds up being so dark and so destructive. I was very engaged in this the whole way through.
Is it a tough watch?
I wouldn't say it's too tough. I mean, what helps is you have characters like Daniel Brooks, who plays one of her best friends, who plays a local bartender, who's so funny and so amazing and is just such a burst of life. This trailer park feels very populated with personalities, and I think that takes a while.
Real people, what I call a real Ilya Kazan sort of cast. These faces, you know,
the old
black dude who everybody calls grandpa. He's not any of the grandpas, and he sits there and he's literally carving. He's whittling, but it's just great, and so funny, yes, but heavy and about a thing.
All right. And by the way, this is the fifth film, and plus she's done television work, so she, for her age, is an experienced hand. Sophia Mitry-Schloss stars with Melanie Lynskey in Sadie, our critics recommending Megan Griffith's film. Griffith's the writer-director. It's unrated. You can see it in Hollywood, at the Arena Cine Lounge Sunset. Also this week, Beautiful Boy, a drama starring Steve Carell and Timothy Chalamet. It's directed by Felix van Groeningen. It's co-written with Luke Davies. The film, based on the books Beautiful Boy by David Sheff and Tweak by Nick Sheff, chronicling the experience of survival, relapse, and recovery in a family coping with addiction over the years.
You think that you have this under control.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand how scared you are.
I understand why I do things. It doesn't make me any different, all right? I'm attracted to craziness, and you're just embarrassed because I was like, you know, I was like this amazing thing, like your special creation or something, And you don't like who I am now.
Yeah, who are you, Nick?
This is me, Dad. Here, this is who I am.
Beautiful boy. Tim?
Well, these films come in three types. The version where the family is relatively speaking poor or underclass, the version where the families are well-to-do, and the version where the family is middle class, and that's the version that this one is, right? They make for very different movies when you're watching these things. The version where the family is underclass and poor, they're very short movies because there's really nothing to be done. This is the kind of film where Steve Carell, who has a wife, a current wife, and two new kids, and an ex-wife out here in California, they feel like there's something to be done. And they marshal all of their resources and every cent they have, and they do rehab after rehab after rehab.
For their son.
For their son, Timothy Chalamet, playing this boy, who's this beautiful boy, like literally beautiful, brilliant, smart, gets into every college. And then one day, tries something that he shouldn't have tried. The film is very much about how sometimes this is simply a matter of brain chemistry. It has nothing to do with that human being. When these things get a hold of some people, it simply has them, and that's all there is to it. And it doesn't make any difference what class you come from. I love the way this movie wanders around the pain and anguish of his parents. Every time they think they got him back, it'll break your heart.
Beautiful Boy is the film. It's at the Landmark in West L.A., the Arclight Hollywood. It's rated R. Steve Carell, Timothy Chalamet star, Felix Van Groeningen is the director and co-screenwriter. After Everything, a dramatic comedy written and directed by Hannah Marks and Joey Power. They both make their feature writing directing debut. Jeremy Allen White and Micah Monroe star. Amy?
Yeah, this is a young romantic comedy about a couple who, on their very first date, the boy just blurts out that he's been diagnosed with cancer because he hasn't been able to tell anyone else that this date with this girl might not go very well. He needs to tell somebody. He gets it out there. And what happens is this is about young love from two people who are very aimless. The boy has an app that he's never really going to code that will never, ever make him a millionaire. The girl is just an office worker at a company that she really isn't interested in. And them being young and in love and fighting cancer makes them both bloom. It's almost like an aphrodisiac. So it's this interesting romantic drama about how cancer brings them together, makes them feel special, makes them feel noble. And then what happens after that? It speeds up and slows down very fast. But I thought all the emotional beats in this film were really true. It's a really smart debut from two very, very, very young writer-directors. Hannah Marks is a young actress who people might have seen in a few things. Joey Power has been a very young director. And to see these two young filmmakers make a film with this much emotional intelligence really impressed me. And also, Micah Monroe is an actress. She's been in a bunch of horror films. She was in It Follows. She was in The Guest. She's amazing. And so getting to see her in a dramatic role, I think, is really great.
Movies After Everything, written and directed by Hannah Marks and Joey Power. It's unrated at the Vintage Los Feliz. Moynihan, a biographical documentary of Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who was a senator from New York, ambassador, and a highly influential intellectual in American life. Tim?
A highly influential intellectual who was born in Hell's Kitchen. To a single mother, abandoned by his father very, very young, grew up a brawler. Daniel Patrick Moynihan came into my life in the middle 70s or something when I was 13, 14 years old and deeply into politics. And he was the guy with the bow tie and the little glasses, and he spoke so eloquently. And I had always thought that he was like the Kennedys from on high.
Because that's the image he projected.
He projected it, but he developed that image, but no. He was from Hell's Kitchen. And the Daniel Patrick Moynihan that I knew was fairly venerated in the black community. But there had been a moment in the 60s when he wrote a report called The Negro Family, A Case for National Action. And that report was interpreted mostly by black radicals and liberals as an attack on black people. And here was this man who was dedicated, actually, to equality and civil rights and all of that. And he was being attacked from the left. And being attacked from the right. And he reared up on his hind legs and he fought back. This is a fascinating film. Goes back into the deep history of his life. I learned so much. And I got to tell you, you want to know what's going on in politics today? Watch this movie. And Daniel Patrick Moynihan will tell you what's going on. You hear his voice quite often, but he's never actually interviewed in a sit-down, on-camera interview in the film. We just hear his voice from various different sources. All kinds of wonderful footage, towering intellects from every community that you can think of across the 60s, 70s, and 80s.
And a man who was very respected and regarded within the Senate at the same time. And the other thing, the report that you mentioned that he led, you know, there were a lot of complex results in that. I hope the film got into that because it was so sort of dumbed down with people that attacked him, as you say, from both the left and the right.
Yeah, and they did. The report, for one thing, was never meant to be made public. All right, it was leaked, so we were still doing that back then, and
goes back to the revolution.
and you're right; it's a very complicated report. Dr. Martin Luther King felt that report was very salient, but he never said it publicly, and he told Patrick Moynihan, "I'll never be able to say this publicly."
Moynihan, the documentary, Lemley's Music Hall in Beverly Hills. It's directed by Joseph Dorman and Toby Pearl Freelich. It's unrated. 22 July is a story of Norway's terrorist attack in which over 70 people were killed. Is it the 10-year anniversary of that attack? The film is from Norway, and it's written and directed by the tremendous talent Paul Greengrass. Amy, what'd you think of the film?
Yeah, you know, Paul Greengrass does a bunch of Bourne films, but he also did United 93, the story of R-9/11.
So good.
So good. And that film was just very dry, very deadpan, very like real time. This is how it went. He's looking for something larger here in 22 July. For a minute, I thought this might be real time. It begins as though it is and then covers the end of the court case. It covers everything. This is the case, by the way, where a young man blew up a building in Oslo and then went to the island and ended up shooting a bunch of young children that he believed were the kids of the wealthy and therefore people who are going to ruin the planet. And it was up to him to sort of shock people into shutting down immigration. And what this film is I enjoy that it takes the shooter and it doesn't do the thing where you could at all look at him and think that he could be a hero. They make him extra pathetic, I felt like. They make him seem like someone you could never respect. Not quite a monster, but someone without any heroic underpinning, which I think is really good. Because I worry sometimes when you have films that give a lot of time to a real-life shooter like this, that he can inspire more because this shooter actually definitely wanted to. And what sort of happens after the attack? Greengrass takes care to not make it lurid at all with any of the shootings. Instead, he singles out one survivor. And they sort of build forward to this moment where they're both facing each other down in the courtroom with one young man representing where Norway could be going forward as like a progressive country that supports immigration. And then the one young man who wants to shut it down. I found this film a little long and a little dry. I found it intellectually really respectable. What did you think, Tim?
Greengrassian is what it is. I think that there is something that we can call a Paul Greengrass film, and certainly the beginning of this film, which almost has no dialogue in it at all. We follow this young man as he carries out his attack. So he just lays that out, not quickly, but methodically. And I do love that Paul Greengrass is a director that knows that you do not need every character to literally say everything that they are thinking for the audience to catch on. He understands that. Now, after we get past that and the guy is under arrest and we get into this sort of look at what this has done to society, the legal system, to the politics of the country, what he's doing then is he's exploring how are we going to react to this. The movie isn't about that guy at all. The movie is about everybody else in Norway, everybody in Norway except that one guy. And that's what I think is the most interesting, intriguing thing about this movie.
All right. And you've coined Greengrassian for Paul Greengrass, the director of the film. And it's not as long ago as I thought in my introduction, 7 years ago, that this horrible attack was carried out in Norway. 22 July is the biographical drama. It's at selected theaters, also streaming on Netflix. The movie's rated R. And the writer-director, Paul Greengrass, was a guest on The Frame with John Horn. You can hear that conversation by visiting our Film Week page at kpecc.org. Coming up, we'll hear what Tim and Amy think of Apostle, as well as The Sentence, and we'll talk with a rocket scientist we had on earlier this week on Air Talk. She's a big fan of the film about Neil Armstrong, First Man. We'll talk about favorite films that have space as a theme. Back in just a couple minutes. Coming up a little bit later on Film Week, we'll talk about favorite space films. Which ones are the most realistic? We brought a pro in to talk with us about the science that's on display in these movies. She was with us on Air Talk earlier in the week. She's an aerospace engineer and rocket scientist, Anita Sengupta, who was at JPL for nearly two decades and is an adjunct research associate professor of astronautics at USC, among other things. So she'll be joining us in a few minutes. But first, we have a few more films this week to talk about. Next is the horror thriller Apostle, written and directed by Gareth Evans. Amy?
Yeah, Gareth Evans is a big name to cult action fans for two movies, The Raid and The Raid 2. This is him showing he can do more things than having people beat each other up to death in Jakarta, which those movies are super fun.
Yeah.
Are you guys laughing because you like them? Or
I loved your introduction to the two big movies.
Well, they are special. And this is him showing he can do something more in the key of like a period piece gothic thriller. This has Dan Stevens going to an island off the British Isles where there's sort of a proto-Jamestown thing happening in ye olden days. He's a heroin addict. He's trying to rescue his sister who's been held hostage. And this island, of course, has a dark Wicker Man sort of secret that gets revealed. But really what Gareth Evans is trying to reveal is just that he can also do bloody, horrible, gory, shocking, kind of delightful, but also overlong things in a movie with a totally different setting. This is kind of an advertisement for his career.
I'm a sucker for these sorts of small village religious cult human sacrifice films.
You've got
long as they're not too violent as contradictory as that sounds.
They're not going to work.
Yeah,
not
human
work,
sacrifice, but low on the violence.
Not going to work for you. These movies can be interesting if they approach these things in a very sort of particular way, right? And this one seems to be. You're into this movie. Dan Stevens is quite good in it. Everybody's quite good in Michael Sheen. That's just cult, and he gives these speeches standing there about Lord and the fire and brimstone and all this stuff. And if it were just that, and this were simply about this heroin addict trying to save his sister from this crazy cult and fight his way off that island, I would really like this movie. But it's not. It's mystically and magically. And that's cheating.
Your rules adhered to in the film.
You really want to do this right, don't cheat.
Apostle, the horror thriller. It's streaming on Netflix. You can see it also on the big screen for a big thrilling experience. Lemley's NoHo Theater, North Hollywood. It's unrated, written and directed by Gareth Evans. The documentary The Sentence is directed by Rudy Valdez, making his feature documentary directorial debut. Tim?
A young woman named Cindy Shank in Michigan got involved with a boyfriend, you know, one of these kind of guys, and he was a nice guy, and she fell in love. Turned out that he was dealing drugs. When he gets busted, she, as the girlfriend who was not participating in the drug dealing at all but knew about it, gets sentenced to 15 years because of the way the sentencing structure
mandatory minimums
and all this stuff. But it's perfectly insane. She has a chance to plea bargain. She won't do it. She wants to fight back against this as just an idea. He was my boyfriend. I wasn't doing anything. You're just beating me up now. And frankly, this is only happening to women. The boyfriends of female drug dealers don't get it. It was only happening to women. This film is all about her experience as made by her brother, who is the director of the film. One thing that comes across wonderfully in this film, she has these two young daughters, is how wonderful a mother she is, locked up in prison, still mothering her daughters as best as she can on the phone and letters and cards, and how her entire family apparatus around her, her other brothers and sisters and aunts and uncles, are set up to make sure that those little girls understand that her mother is right there and she'll be back. And we go through a whole bunch of stuff, but it's just a really powerful film. These sentencing men, they're just insane. They're crazy, and they beat up the women. The boyfriend would have gotten out of prison before her. That's how crazy these laws are.
The Sentence is the film. It's an HBO documentary. You can see it on HBO next week. You can also see it right now at Lemley's Playhouse in Pasadena. Rudy Valdez, the director, and it's unrated. The Kindergarten Teacher stars Maggie Gyllenhaal and Parker Sivak with Gael Garcia Bernal. Sarah Colangelo is the writer-director. Tim?
Well, this is a very good movie. A bit of a controversy about it. A little bitty boy in kindergarten. kindergarten, has this amazing ability to compose this poetry, sort of like a savant. His kindergarten teacher, played by Maggie Gyllenhaal, is deeply impressed by this. Now, she's going through some issues of her own as she takes this writing class, and she comes to realize that she's not a very good poet, the class being taught by Gael Garcia Bernal. Now, yeah, she takes the kid's poetry, and she starts passing it off as her own, but that's not what this movie is about. This movie isn't about that at all. This movie is about love and how love can become extremely misdirected. And that's what the controversy was about. There's this sort of proto-romantic thing going on between this grown woman and this five-year-old boy who writes this beautiful poetry that she is enthralled by. And she does something that's a little bit crazy.
The Kindergarten Teacher. It's streaming on Netflix. It's also at Landmark's Regent Theater in Westwood, rated R. And finally this week, the documentary Studio 54 about the club that burned so bright for a few years in the heart of New York City. Tim?
Went to Studio 54 in 1978.
Did you?
My daddy took me to Studio 54. My dad did a lot of inappropriate things with me, but, you know, we had a hell of a lot of fun. And Studio 54 was a fantastic place. This documentary is a lot of fun. All kinds of figures, you know, the Drew Barrymores and all that kind of stuff that hung around Studio 54, as well as the owners of the club. Look, it was a bright and shining star that was bound to burn out hot and fast, and it did. This is a lot of fun, a throwback to an era. I think you should check it out if you're, like, over 55.
I had the pleasure of hearing Nile Rodgers talk about the stories of Studio 54 in the heyday.
Yeah.
Wow. Studio 54, the documentary, is unrated. It's at the New Art Theater in West Los Angeles. So now we turn our attention to the science in films devoted to space and which ones you think are strongest. I'd love to have your feedback on it at 866-893-KPCC. If you're listening live to Friday's Film Week, you can also share it on our Film Week page at kpecc.org. With me is Anita Sengupta, formerly of Jet Propulsion Lab, NASA facility in La Cañada, Flint Ridge. She's a senior VP of Systems Engineering for Virgin Hyperloop One and also teaches at USC in the aeronautics program. Anita, thank you for joining us again. I appreciate it. You were sharing with me off air when you were in earlier this week that you thought the new film that tells the story of the first moon landing and particularly the personal story of Neil Armstrong, first man, was just a great film. What made it work so well for you?
So to start off with, I'm a massive science fiction fan and space buff. And I think one of the reasons why people become science fiction fans is somebody said it, not me, but it inspires a sense of wonder, the exploration of the unknown and the technologies that take you to get to that place. And so what was so unique about this movie versus all the other space movies that I've seen before is that versus seeing like a two-dimensional scroller of different people talking back and forth, this was actually the story through the eyes of an individual. So you felt as though you were experiencing what Neil Armstrong was experiencing in like a first person type of way as opposed to a third person type of way. And so there was the emotional aspect of that, of actually experiencing it through his eyes. And the quality of the special effects, I mean, it looked real. The quality of how they put together the different engineering scenarios that they did for the Gemini testing that he was originally a part of. And then, of course, the actual moon landing and everything going from launch to cruise to rendezvous and docking to landing on the surface. All of that was actually completely accurate from an engineering perspective. So I was just in awe of how it was the perfect package of a beautiful film, beautiful cinematography, accurate engineering, and finally a space movie where you're experiencing it as the individual.
Why do you think it's so difficult for these movies to get the engineering part right?
I don't know. I mean, it seems like, you know, there's no shortage of people in the Los Angeles area, as we talked about the last program, where they have an expertise in this. But it could be that maybe some people want the sort of whiz-bang action aspect movies, and so they focus on that and make it silly. And I think they almost always come off best when they're most accurate. And so you could go back several decades to 2001, A Space Odyssey, and 2010. Those are another examples of movies that I think did it more accurately and had far more of a profound impact.
Even though they're set so far in the future.
Exactly. And I think they still did a great way of representing the geopolitical conflicts, the way that we would interpret interacting with an alien species, I guess, in the context of 2001. And I think what this movie also did very well, because, I mean, I've seen La La Land, and it's the same director, I believe.
Yeah, Damien Chazelle.
Is they were able to combine the right times to play the right music and the right times to have silence.
All right. We'll continue our conversation, but I'd like to hear from you, your favorite films that are set in space, 866-893-KPCC, back in a minute on Film Week. Which film set in space get it most right? That's what we're talking about on Film Week this week, that saw the release of First Man, the story of Neil Armstrong. Ryan Gosling stars as the astronaut who first set foot on the moon. We're at 866-893-KPCC for those listening live. Amy Nicholson with us, Tim Cogshell as well. Amy, do you have a favorite that you just, you know, I know you're not a scientist, but that feels really authentic?
Gosh, you know, I always think of a book, James Michener's Space. I know that we're on a movie program, but James Michener's Space is one of my all-time favorite books, and it's also the story of the initial rocket builders to landing a man on the moon, and then what happened in science after that. James Michener gives a little speech in the book about how he's worried that since we did something so intimidating, I suppose, to humans, that we might enter a period of anti-science, which he wrote that in 1981, and I think about that all the time. That book means so much to me.
As we live in the middle of this period of anti-science, the right stuff.
At the same time, science is progressing pretty dramatically.
Yeah, yeah, and quickly, despite the right stuff in terms of the Apollo.
I love
missions,
the right stuff.
You know, so meticulous. Of course, it's not just a movie. It's a big old series, and of course, the acting is just extraordinary. The Ed Harris, Sam Washington, everybody is in that movie. But I suppose if we go all the way back to the 50s, right? So I think that's when, I mean, there's 1929, the woman on the moon. But in the 50s is when I think we tried to start thinking about space travel in a quasi-realistic way. So you have movies like Rocket Ship XM, which is about a mission to the moon, which goes awry, and they end up on Mars, which is a little crazy.
That's not accurate.
But the intention was correct. And they experienced things like asteroid storms and things like that. They were thinking about stuff like that. Conquest of the Moon, about 1955 or something like that, they have airlocks in that movie. They're really thinking about the way this would actually have to work. There ends up being aliens, but other than that, we're there. Then when we get to the 60s, it's when just the space travel itself becomes relevant, as you said, 2001 and films like that. In the 70s, it all becomes space opera, of course, Star Wars and all of the myriad knockoffs of Star Wars. And then I suppose in the 80s and 90s, we get back to quasi-serious space travel again, Red Planet. Mission to Mars, the De Palma film, things like that. There's still usually some sort of aspect of a horror film or something going on, but the technology, they're working really hard on getting the technology right by the time you get there.
There's one when I was a kid I remember that I like. Marooned was the movie about astronauts who get trapped, no way to return. 1969, so it would have been 10 years old for me. And it was released just after the Apollo 11 moon landing, won the Oscar for Best Visual Effects, and NASA provided authentic replicas of equipment and an early Skylab mock-up for that film, Marooned, from 1969. Ben in Culver City says, and not necessarily realistic, but his favorite space film is Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, which just has such a great performance by Ricardo Montalban. I think probably his best performance in a whole career of terrific performances, but that's such a great one. Let's talk with Teresa, who joins us from Van Nuys. Teresa, your favorite space film?
Larry, two words, Forbidden Planet.
Wow. Walter Pidgeon. Yeah, Forbidden Planet.
1956, Fred Wilcox directed that movie. The technology, the state, for one thing, that was a studio film. That was not a B movie. That theremin and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and it was very lush looking.
Yeah. Of course, it's just the Tempest. It's the Tempest sort of reconstructed. And it's just lovely. Really love Forbidden Planet.
Yeah. So, Teresa, that's still your favorite space film? All right.
That was it. For Forbidden Planet.
All right. Thanks so much. Bill in the San Gabriel Valley says Apollo 13 is one of my two favorite movies. It satisfies the space program side of me. And I'm wondering if First Man might replace that. I also love 2001. I consider, Bill says, Star Wars, Star Trek more as popular sci-fi. So I put them in a little bit of a different category as opposed to movies like The Martian that would have more realism in it. Anita, what do you think of The Martian?
I thought it was a wonderful movie. The book, I highly recommend reading it if you haven't, because it goes into excruciating technical details. So you can actually make sure that it makes sense. So I thought the movie was quite accurate. I think the technology challenges and the technology solutions that the lead character came up with were correct. I think the premise was a bit flawed, which was the absolute loss of the communication signal, because you always invariably have multiple antennas. So that was my one issue. And of course, we do have an orbiting with several satellites that orbit Mars, specifically the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. So I'm pretty sure they would have been able to see that he was on the surface before that. Other than that, that minor nit, it was a wonderful and accurate engineering film.
So Interstellar, as I recall, there was some controversy about the sciences depicted in that film, despite it's a very, very popular movie. What did you think of it?
Well, I absolutely love Interstellar, and I'll tell you, one of my guilty pleasures of international plane travel is I always watch Interstellar on every flight that I
really?
Go on. I do. I absolutely love it. So Kip Thorne was part of that movie in terms of providing technical input. So I think a lot of it is just really thinking outside of the box. And I think part of what makes science fiction so wonderful, though, is that you can't always think about things in the context of how we do understand physics, how we do understand particle physics or quantum mechanics. So I think that movie tried to make us think outside of that box and perhaps went a bit too far. But at the same time, it was very entertaining and it was very beautifully done.
Yeah. Pippi writes Red Planet with Val Kilmer and Carrie Ann Moss.
Yeah.
That sounds like something you would have seen, Tim.
Oh, yeah. Red Planet yeah. is on my list. And again, working real hard on the science and the technology of that movie. And then they had to turn that robot into a monster because, you got to have something else going on in the movie. But they're working real hard on that speculative science, the spacesuits and things like that, which I saw the new NASA design for spacesuits, and they look a lot like the spacesuits in Red Planet. Sort of, I would wear one of those, on Earth, but not on Mars. It was really slick.
Now, a movie I haven't seen from 1968 that apparently Robert Altman was directing called Countdown. Have you heard of this film?
I don't know Countdown.
So, yeah, I was seeing this Variety article that goes back a few years ago. But apparently it was a Cold War thriller about two American astronauts trying to beat the Soviets to the moon. But Altman was fired by Warner Brothers, according to Variety, because he wouldn't reshoot. He had the overlapping dialogue thing, and they didn't want that. And he refused to reshoot it, so he was fired by the film. But apparently NASA granted Altman tremendous access for doing that film. So that's 50 years ago this year, that film. All right. Amy, any others you want to add to your list?
Oh, I'm just intrigued that nobody's called in to say anything about the Ridley Scott Prometheuses, which I'm fine with. I'm fine with them. Yeah, I mean, it is interesting to Tim's point. Like, why do we always need to throw a monster into a space movie? Why can't space just be awesome enough? And to me, that is frustrating. Mm. I think space on its own should be great. I wish Ridley Scott made alien movies where there wasn't always some poisonous plant that then would take people over. I think just being stranded is enough.
All right.
I agree.
Anita, you should make your own film now. So you're such a film buff. You should go out and direct. Thank you for joining us. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you for having me.
Anita Sengupta with us, rocket scientist, aerospace engineer. She was with JPL for nearly 20 years, teaches astronautics at USC, and is senior VP at Virgin Hyperloop 1. For our Film Week critics, Amy and Tim, I'm Larry Mantle, inviting you to come join us in person. Our next Film Week screening series at the Theater at Ace Hotel, Sunday afternoon, December 2nd, 1 o'clock. We'll show the Oscar-winning film The Artist. What better place than a beautiful historic theater to see a film that pays tribute to the movie industry here in L.A. as it moved from silent to talkies from the 20s to 30s. Tickets at kpcc.org/in-person. From all of us, have a great weekend.